Good afternoon. I guess this qualifies as afternoon. We're really happy to have such a full house, and we're going to launch in. Julie and I are going to have a bit of a conversation for a few minutes, and then we're going to leave plenty of time to answer all of your questions too. My name is Leslie Gilbert Lurie. I was here with my book a few years ago. I wrote a memoir called Bending Toward the Sun, which is a three-generational journey about my mother, who was a Holocaust survivor, who hid in an attic for 2 years during the Holocaust. And it is my honor and pleasure to get to interview Julie Lindahl today, who is here with her book, The Pendulum, A Granddaughter's Search for Her Family's Forbidden Nazi Past. I think this conversation should be rich and interesting and healing and really important as a model for what we hope is taking place a lot of other places in the world too. Let me tell you a little bit about Julie. She is an author and educator. She was born in Brazil, and she currently lives in Sweden. She writes and speaks widely about her experiences. She's a contributor to WBUR here, Cognoscenti, and she has been featured on National Public Radio. Julie holds a BA from Wellesley College, an MPhil in International Relations from Oxford University, and was a Fulbright Scholar in Frankfurt, Germany. She was raised in 10 countries on 3 continents. She's worked globally as a consultant. She's the founder of Stories for Society, which is a nonprofit organization for renewing the art of storytelling among youth for social transformation. WBUR 9.0, is that how you say it? Won the 2018 Edward R. Murrow Award for Excellence in Innovation and the 2018 Associated Press Media Editors Award for Innovation in Storytelling, based on a program series featuring Julie's story. Julie, can you take a few minutes and just give us a summary of your story and where you take us in this book? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I would describe this book as having two levels to it. The story is having two levels to it. At one level, it describes a six-year journey that started in 2010 of starting to look squarely at something that I had suspected for some time. I think that many people have family secrets, and many people often look away from them in order to remain loyal to their families and to respect their families, and that's what I did. But the book reveals what the journey was like of discovering that my grandparents were SS in occupied Poland throughout the duration of World War II, as well as the discovery that they fled Germany to Brazil in 1960 when a new wave of war crimes trials started in the Federal Republic. I was born in Brazil, as Leslie mentioned, and so it's very personal to me. I didn't know about this history. At another level, the book is about the desire to find a transformational process. How do we convert our knowledge about the histories that our families and our societies have experienced into a force powerful enough to take us in a different direction? And really, a lot of the book is about that.
Great. So when and why did you decide to embark on this venture? And can you just tell us a little bit about what were you hoping to learn when you got this idea to write this book?
Well, I should say that the idea to write the book didn't come at the same time as my taking the decision to face this past. As you can imagine, it was an extremely personal and difficult thing to do, particularly as I didn't have the support of my family, my extended family. Nobody really wanted me to look into it, except perhaps for my sister. And so the way that I came to the story was that I think it started way back in childhood. I always felt rather ashamed because when I was small, my mother was often very angry. And well, when you're a child, we all know this, that if your parent is angry, you think you've done something wrong. It's a fairly logical thought process for a young child. And the problem was that I could never know what it was that I had done wrong, because actually I hadn't done anything wrong to make my mother angry. There were other things that made her angry. I just didn't know that. And so this carried on and on. I became very close to my maternal grandmother, who I had many things in common with, our love of literature and music and so forth, but who never let go of her old ideology, and there were shards of that everywhere in our conversations. And of course, since I later on became a student of Polish-German history in my master's degree, I actually instinctively probably chose Polish-German relations in the 20th century. I started to become aware that our family had been engaged in the Third Reich in some way, and I didn't know. I had to go in and look at this. And actually, at the time in 2010, when I started to do it, when I took myself to the German Federal Archives, it was out of desperation, because almost all of my most important family relationships had been asphyxiated by the failure to tell the truth in our family. So we couldn't speak with each other anymore. So I more or less crawled to the Bundesarchiv to find an answer. And as far as the book goes, when I decided to start to write it and how I came to that. Well, I'm a writer and I write memoir, and it's my way of processing things. It's my way of taking care of the things that I don't understand. Those of you who are memoirists will understand that. Then there is a question as to whether you have to publish everything you write. And that was a very big struggle for me. I wrote one version, or I wrote a second version. I made new discoveries. What this is today isn't at all mm-hmm. what it's been in the past. And eventually the thing that swung it for me, the thing that made me feel that you cannot keep this in your desk drawer, was that I saw what was happening in the world, and I felt that I had a responsibility to do something, and perhaps if I put this out in the world, I could start to engage in that transformational process that I was talking about.
And we're going to talk more about transformation, but I wanted to ask you just one follow-up question. You said in your book, quote, to pursue the answers to my questions, risk the unimaginable. What to you, what was the unimaginable? What were your greatest fears in pursuing the subject?
Well, of course, I was afraid of what I would discover. You know, the degree of silence and secretiveness and actually lying that went on in my family suggested to me that there were very serious things that my grandparents had been engaged in, which ended up being correct. But there was something else. The unimaginable was betraying my family, because really. And that's one of the... There are a lot of people like me out in the world. There are a lot of grandchildren of perpetrators out in the world, but most of us don't speak out. And the reason we don't speak out is because it means that we will have to probably sacrifice some of our family relationships. And hopefully not. Hopefully, eventually, people will come around. And actually, hopefully, some people will find this a release and find that they don't have to walk with this burden anymore. They can do something positive instead. But the reality is that there are some relationships that will vanish from your life. Mm-hmm. And that's the unimaginable. Yeah.
Mm. Your book is called The Pendulum. Mm-hmm. And your grandmother had a pendulum in her home, which she used to mm-hmm. divine good from bad mm-hmm. and true and false. Why did you choose to use that as the title of your book, and what did that symbolize for you?
Yes, my publisher actually argued a lot with me about that, but I won in the end, mm-hmm. and I think I won with good reason. This pendulum, which is actually my bag, I was going to take it mm-hmm. out, this pendulum that my grandmother had, and then she also gave me one, seemed to me as though it was a sort of crutch. For someone who had lost their moral bearings, so she was no longer able herself to put her mind to the questions of whether something was right or wrong or true or false. I mean, these can be very big questions in some cases, but she couldn't trust herself anymore. And so to me, it was as though she had to rely on this object. And to me, this was a symbol for what happens to us when we become completely unmoored from the truth, because she was completely unmoored from the truth. She lied about what she and my grandfather had done. And the other, for me, the pendulum also represents me and the way I felt throughout this journey. I can't tell you the number of times that I wanted to turn back and not do this work anymore. Every step I took, there were possibilities for me to say, no, I'm not going to take this step now. Every archive I went to, and I knew, I was told there are documents here about your grandfather, I thought, I could turn back now. I don't have to open these documents. And the documents usually contained horrendous accounts of things he did. So it represents me and the way that I felt, this sort of swinging back and forth between, do I do this or don't I do it?
I wanted to talk to you about transmission of experiences from generation to generation. You said in your book, when a generation responsible for evil deeds rejects its own guilt, it creeps insidiously into the hearts and minds of the next generation and transforms it into shame. I was really interested in this. I've told you, Julie, that throughout the book, I was fascinated by the similarities in Julie delving into her past and the challenges and satisfaction I found in delving into my mother's past. I talk a lot in my book about the transmission of trauma from generation to generation, from my mother to me to my daughter. And so I was really interested to see you talking about the transmission of shame. And can you talk a little bit about that? I know that in terms of trauma, there are all kinds of theories, sociological theories, psychoanalytic theories, biological theories, a whole world of epigenetics in terms of how trauma gets transmitted. How does shame get transmitted from generation to generation?
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, shame is a form of trauma. And shame doesn't start as shame. Shame starts as guilt. And guilt is, to me, something that you bear with you because of something you know you've done. So you know what it is that's happened, and it's a feeling you have about that, which is that it was wrong. And so the generation that should have felt this guilt, namely my grandparents, they didn't feel it, or at least they didn't show it. And I actually tried to... It's probably one of the reasons why, in the end, I did confront my grandmother with what I knew, because I wanted to see whether I could at least find some form of remorse. And unfortunately, I couldn't find it. And so what happens is that when that generation doesn't take responsibility for its own guilt, then the next generation, their children, so my mother's generation, end up being lumped with it. If you think of my mother, she, you know, her father, after the war, her father surrounded himself in a former SS network. She worked in a business that he started. She knew of the people that he had surrounded himself, and they knew, all the children knew. They didn't know precisely what he had done, but they knew who he had been, and that he had been part of the SS. And she probably went to school during the days, and at that time in Germany it was mandatory to watch these films of the, you know, of when the camps were opened and the dreadful scenes that were discovered there. So how do you react to that as a teenager? Of course you become extremely confused. And so in her generation, she was lumped with what became shame. It couldn't be guilt because she didn't do anything. Her generation didn't commit these crimes. And in the case of my family, my mother didn't want to deal with that either. And I mean, I forgive her. I sympathize with her. I'm so happy I did this work because I understand her much better now. But unfortunately, she was not able to deal with this. And she loved her father. She loved him very much. And I think every child has the right to love their parent. You can't take that away from them. And instead of rejecting him, she tried to please him, I think, by repeating some of his ideology and things. And was generally angry and indignant. So her shame then came over to me because she didn't want to deal with it. She didn't want to face the past. So it came to me, and it came to my sister, and it came to us in the form of this anger that I told you about earlier, in which I went around really assuming that I had to feel ashamed because that's just the way life was.
And what about your children?
Well, I think it's very hard for me to say how that's going to play. Mm-hmm. How this is probably in your case too. It's I think one of your children is here, so I don't want to we can't assume anything. Mm-hmm. Our children have to make up their own minds about these things. What I hope, I know that I have transmitted something to my two 20-year-olds. But what I hope is that I don't transmit shame. Mm-hmm. Because it's a dreadful thing to carry around with you. It's like a brick wall. You cannot make progress with your life. And that I don't want to leave them with. I might, there are all kinds of other things I'm going to have to ask their forgiveness for, but not that.
So let's pursue forgiveness a little bit. You talk about it in different ways throughout your story. At one point, you quote your uncle's wife, Luna, mm-hmm. and she says, forgiveness is the highest privilege God grants us. And you talk about them, she believes they are living peacefully. Mm-hmm. And then you also say, as I traveled through the Polish countryside and met people whose lives were irreparably damaged by the racial scourge of the Nazis, I understood that it was not up to me to forgive my grandparents. Rather, it was up to the people they had wronged. Are you hopeful that what form would you be hopeful that forgiveness takes? What would that look like?
I have struggled with the word forgiveness, at least in terms of my seeking forgiveness. I can't seek forgiveness. Mm-hmm. For the deeds that my grandparents committed. It simply doesn't make any sense. I didn't commit these deeds. This is something I had to learn. It's not something I started off with. I actually went out trying to seek forgiveness. When I set out into the Polish countryside with a young Polish historian, and we had these eyewitness accounts of what my grandfather had done on his estate, and managed to track down some of the families. And there's one particular instance I want to describe because it really explains what happened with forgiveness for me and what I think about it in my particular case and in the case of descendants of the perpetrators. There was a man who had been a young boy at the time when my grandfather was the overlord on an estate that he worked on, and his father worked on as slave labor. And so he was in his 80s, and he had quite a substantial scar over his right eye. He was very kind to me. He welcomed me in. We sat actually for 4 hours, and I just listened to him, and he told me about, you know, my grandfather used to beat his father to unconsciousness on a near daily basis, and actually beat him over the head when he was a 10-year-old, which is why he had the scar over his eye. So you can imagine that I felt awful. I wished that I could seek forgiveness on behalf of my grandparents, but actually this man could see in my face that this was a hopeless rat race that I was caught in. I could never do anything productive with this if I stayed in that looking for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. And so at the end of our four-hour discussion, we got up. He took me by the lower arms here, and he shook me a little bit, and he said, "Let me tell you something. It's not your fault." Okay. Now I want you to go out into my garden and see the beauty. And he freed me. And that doesn't mean I'm free of this story. No, I have a responsibility. But that is the dynamic I started off talking about. What is the dynamic that allows us to transform these awful experiences into something productive that creates a powerful enough force to change the direction of our society? And I would say that type of moment is an example. So for me, forgiveness was not an appropriate way to approach doing something about this. There are people, you referred to my uncle's wife. Her faith is very important to her, and forgiveness plays an important role in her faith. And so that was a vehicle for her. She needed to forgive her husband for certain types of behaviors. and I understand that. But I think we have to be, whenever we talk about forgiveness, we have to ask about forgiveness for what? Forgiveness by whom? Forgiveness for whom? We have to be careful about it because it can also be a trap, and it can prevent us from, if it's inappropriate, it can prevent us from actually doing something positive.
Right.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times when people talk about forgiveness, what they're asking about is hope. Mm. I mean, I find that my mother and I speak to students just about every week, and they always ask if we forgive. And I always answer really the way you do, which is, it's not for me to forgive. It's for the human beings who were wrong to forgive. Mm-hmm. But I think that what they are asking is there a hopefulness that we could move on? Is there a hopefulness that people could do something wrong and still repair those things? And I think we're going to, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about hope. I want to talk to you for a minute, though, about writing a memoir about your family. I found that one of the obstacles I kept coming up against was my mother had some very strong feelings about family members, very positive and very negative. And I was always thinking as I wrote, this book is going to impact human beings who are alive and living their lives and not necessarily ready to write their book. And I'm wondering how you dealt with that. You dealt with a very serious subject. Mm-hmm. And are there things you left on the proverbial cutting room floor because you felt it would be unnecessarily upsetting in one way or another? Or how did you deal with your family members as you were going through this process and project?
Well, I guess the first answer is that if you're a memoirist, you aren't a memoirist in order to please other people. And the next piece is that there was absolutely no way for me to do this work or to write this book if I needed to consult everybody in my family, because most of them would not have wanted me to do any of this work at all. So you can, it's something that I have battled with a great deal. What is ethically correct? You know, shouldn't, with something so serious, shouldn't it be a decision by the family? For me, it was more important, given the times we find ourselves in, to move ahead. But at the same time, even with people I was angry at, my mother, certainly my grandparents, to try to understand. That doesn't mean I can never the things that my grandfather did to other people are probably unforgivable. So it's not about forgiving. It's about trying to understand how human beings become who they become. And this is the way that I try to be fair to my family. I actually, I think some people who read, there was a shorter version of the book that came out a few years ago before I went to Latin America, and many people read it at that time. And one of the comments was that, you know, even if the story is dreadful, you can sort of understand the reasons why everyone did what they did, except perhaps my grandfather in the moment where he committed his acts of extreme cruelty. For me, that's completely incomprehensible. But you can try to understand the process by which he became that way. And I think it's very important we do that and don't just say, well, that's evil, stick him in a drawer with Stalin and Hitler and everybody else and put the label on it, because that means we don't have to try to understand a side of our own nature. So.
I want to get to the world today, so I'm going to make sure to leave 10 minutes to get there, and then we're still going to have our 20 minutes of questions. And I told Julie I probably have 3 hours of questions for her, so I'll try to get to a couple more and leave time for today. You talked a lot in the course of your investigating this, your past. You referred to the satisfaction of each missing puzzle piece you found. Mm-hmm. And I was struck that I had used the same words in my memoir. It felt so important to me every time I learned something else about my family's past, even though it might not be relevant to anyone else in the world. I'm wondering, it seems to me that the most surprising puzzle piece you probably came across was that your uncle was alive, whom you had spent your first 40-some years thinking was not alive. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there was any puzzle piece that you never found that you wish you had found, that you still feel is out there.
Oh, there are so many. And I mean, I'm trained to do this kind of research, which was a big advantage, so I could navigate the archives, and when I opened the documents, I was able most of the time to interpret them, and I can speak German. But it's because I know how to do that kind of work that I also know how many gaps there are. I mean, particularly gaps in how my grandfather got into occupied Poland. And what exactly, you know, one thing I spent a lot of time trying to figure out was, what was the smoking gun? So what was the thing that was so bad that he felt he had to flee to Latin America in 1960, when the new trials restarted. And that wasn't so easy to find out, because when I went to the certain archives that are there are some archives in southern Germany that are, it's actually a federal prosecutor's office responsible for pursuing war criminals. They said, well, he's not in our records, so he didn't kill anybody. And I thought, sorry, this is not really reflecting the sort of thing I've been finding in Poland. And so I kept looking. I actually continued to look in their archives, and indeed found that he was in their archives. So they weren't correct about it. But the thing was, he was already dead, so they couldn't take up his case. And there was a testimony that I found, but it's only one testimony, which talks about, you know, murdering the existing landowners in a nearby forest at night. But of course, you need to find other witnesses in order to corroborate that. And so there were lots of things that, there are a lot of questions that remain open, and some of them, I'll never be able to answer some of them, particularly with regard to the organization that my grandfather worked for in the occupied territories, because they were extremely successful at destroying most of their documentation. So I was... finding something out about what your grandparent did at that time is like looking for a needle in a haystack, usually you won't find anything, and a lot of the time most of the supporting documentation is gone. Yeah.
So closure, mm-hmm. you bring it up several times, mm-hmm. in the story. Mm-hmm. You said that when you're finished writing the book, the pendulum came to a standstill, mm-hmm. on the question of looking into the deeds of your forebears. You also said that you had done so, let me just skip that since I can't read my writing. You said at the end, you found stillness in the clarity and love of family, friends, and strangers. Mm-hmm. Are you still feeling that closure? Are you feeling that this is a subject you... What does closure feel like?
Mm. I'm not sure I know what closure really means. Many people wish it for me. And they wish that many of my most cherished friends wish that I could put this behind me now and move on to more pleasant subjects. Matter. I think what you're citing is for me more, it has to do with maybe if we want to use the word closure, I've reached some sort of point of, I've stopped debating with myself as to whether I should or should not have done this. Mm-hmm. I've stopped doing that. It doesn't mean I can answer the question of whether I was right or wrong to do it. I'm sure I'll hurt quite a lot of people. Because I did it, but I hope I do. It's more. It does more good than harm. But I think I've come to a point of stop asking questions about whether it was right or not to do it. Then the question of closure: can I ever put it behind me? Can I sort of say, okay, I've done this now. I can get out of my little shame room and I can get on with my life. I think that's an entirely different question, and I actually think that what has become apparent to me is that I have a very heavy, you know, I have a very heavy responsibility to continue throughout my life to do whatever I can to prevent these kind of forces from emerging again, and that's what I do. I do that all the time. You might know that in Sweden we have had the resurgence of or the emergence of the far right, and I have been working with Holocaust survivors in Sweden to counter that trend. And I'm also an American, so I'm very concerned about what's happening here.
Okay, so let's talk about, mm-hmm. what's happening here. Mm-hmm. And I want to tie it to some comments you made in the book about tribalism mm-hmm. also. You started out saying, when I look back at my grandparents' story and their time, I see the blinding power of greed and the contagion of tribalism. And so I'm wondering, and then at the end, you say, working with students forced me to consider what we could do to change the patterns of history. The warning signs that the world was unraveling in ways similar to your grandparents' past are intensifying with each passing year. So what can we do? What have you learned from all you've learned mm-hmm. that you bring to bear on the students you work with today? Mm-hmm. And what are your thoughts? Mm-hmm.
Well, the students are usually much more creative than I am, but my thinking about this is that we have to come to grips with our human need to belong, because that's kind of what's behind our tribalism. That's what. Greedy politicians can latch onto and use to turn our own society against us, to turn ourselves against ourselves. And so we have to do something about that. What do we do with our need to belong? We can't get rid of it. It's one of our survival mechanisms. But a part of me is also a very global person and has grown up with a global idea. And to me, after the Second World War, after these terrible things that absolutely one of the worst, if not the worst, chapter of human history was over, we were on the way to creating the idea of a global community and giving birth to the idea of universal human rights. And so we started it. We started a new idea. We started the idea that we are global citizens. And now we have to find the courage to take the next step. And what is the next step? And what is each of us prepared to do to realize that global idea? And not to go backwards, which seems to be the trend right now, to go back towards nationalism, towards a form of belonging that has clearly resulted in terrible things for us and for our planet. We have to take that idea that humans gave birth to after the Second World War and nurture it, and each of us in our own lives has to figure out how to transfer our belonging to an idea of humanity. And I think you work with that, Leslie, right? So you know what I'm talking about.
I do. I'm on the International Board of Human Rights Watch mm-hmm. and chair the Los Angeles Committee of Human Rights Watch. Mm-hmm. And I will say that I coincidentally had breakfast 2 days ago with Ben Ferenz, who is the 99-year-old only surviving prosecutor of the Nuremberg trials. And he also created the International Doctrine of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we talked about that morning was our sense that this value that we all sort of took for granted a few years ago, that there was a thing called human rights, exists because we all together believe mm-hmm. that it exists. Mm-hmm. And how do we keep that belief alive, that global communal belief alive? And he said, fight, fight, fight. He said, trust in your bones when you know something is right and keep fighting for it. And I think that's what we all have to do. And that's why we're all here having this conversation. So let's answer your questions. Yes.
So I am fascinated by something that you started to touch on, but I want to see if you have more. After the Treaty of Versailles...
Excuse me for one sec. I want to remind you all that we don't have mics in this room, so if you can ask the question as loudly as possible, that would be great.
So after the Treaty of Versailles and Germany went into economic downturn, mm-hmm. There was an indoctrination that occurred that obviously your grandparents went through. Mm-hmm. Can you shed any light on actually the before and after or the during of that indoctrination period?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I spent a lot of time trying to trace their radicalization and what that process looked like. My grandfather joined the SS through his writing association. He was a very good writer. And you might remember that all of the... there was something called Gleichschaltung that took place in Germany, where all of the public associations were all aligned with the party. They were all sort of absorbed into the party. So through his writing association, he became a member of the Mounted SS. The Mounted SS had weekly propaganda evenings in which you were which you were supposed to attend, and which was focused a great deal on what they called worldview. So that is how you see the world. And the way you were supposed to be trained to see the world on these evenings was that there was a struggle going on, that the world was about a struggle between races. And so my grandfather attended those. And, you know, he joined the SS in 1934, so he had a very long indoctrination period. The idea behind this indoctrination was that eventually, when war broke out, that, you know, I mean, it was Himmler's idea that he wouldn't have to give specific instructions to his men in the SS. He simply had to unleash this propaganda, you know, these people who were full of propaganda, and they would fight the racial war as he had envisioned it, and that's exactly what they did. And my grandfather was a part of the initial invasion, and it was said of those men in the Mounted SS who were a part of that initial invasion that they were never themselves again. And in his case, this was true, and his own family felt it. I mean, this is little known in SS families that, you know, men who are damaged in war can sometimes bring their wars home with them, and he did that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I'll repeat the question.
And it's now almost 80 years after all these things happened. And there's been lots of information, lots published, movies, books, documentation, everything. My question to you is, you had a chance to talk to your parents and to your grandfather. Did they ever try to justify what they had done? Did they ever try to explain it? And at the end of the day, what I really want to know is, how can one human being do something like this to another? Mm-hmm. Despite politics, despite greed, everything else, mm-hmm. How can you understand one person and another person and what can happen?
So the question is, this gentleman is a child of a Holocaust survivor. You are a Holocaust survivor. Mm-hmm. And he's asking, first and foremost, he's asking if Julie spoke with her parents and grandparents about this, and if they ever tried to justify it, and how could one human being do this to another? What is her understanding of how one human being could do this to another?
Well, first of all, I didn't get to ask my grandfather any questions, unfortunately, because I was 4 years old the last time I saw him. So he would come out of the jungle to come and see me, and then he'd, you know. So I have one picture where I'm sitting together with him. So I didn't have the opportunity to ask him questions, of course. But I did have the opportunity to speak with my grandmother, who was equally convinced of what they had been involved in, and she had been a staunch member of something called the NSV, which was a so-called welfare organization that, amongst other things, redistributed the belongings of, well, perhaps belongings of members of your family to other people for something they called the war effort. So she was involved in the whole thing, and she was, as I was doing the work, I could not confront her straight away about it because I wanted to gather enough evidence before I actually asked her, you know, went to her with the hard questions. Because if I was wrong, or if I accused them of the wrong thing, that would have been, you know, would have been inappropriate. So I wanted to be very clear and know what I was talking about before I went to her. Now, she was 101 years old by the time I had gathered all the information and knew for sure what I was talking about. She was clear in her mind, and I said to my husband, I don't think I can do this. She's too old, and, you know, she might have a heart attack or something if I take this up. But my husband was the one who said, look, she's never going to change, but you should tell her what you know, and you should ask her whatever you have to ask her for your own sake, because if you don't, you'll always regret it. So I did. And that conversation is documented in this book. And it was a very difficult conversation because she did not take responsibility for anything. She showed no remorse. Rather, she defended everything they did and actually tried to paint this as a beautiful time, it's violence to portray this as a beautiful time. I felt as though violence was being recommitted, you know, at that time when she was telling me these things. But at least I was honest with her and told her what I knew and confronted her with it. Now, to your other question,
and I just want to say this is documented in the,
yeah,
in the book.
Yeah. The other question of whether I can ever understand how one human being can commit such violent acts against another, particularly a human being who is not able to defend themselves. I think this is the point. It's the one moment, it's the one part of trying to understand that can't be understood. I think it's that one piece of our human nature we cannot understand. And maybe we just have to say that piece we can't understand. We can figure out how we get there, which is the important thing, so that we don't end up there. We never commit those acts against other human beings again. But in that moment, there is no explanation. There's no justification.
And there never is a justification. As you know, obviously, though, that was a distinct strategy of Hitler's, right, was to dehumanize Jewish people and all his victims, to starve them, to make them as animal-like as possible, mm-hmm, so that human beings did not have to feel that they were harming human beings. He tried to make them not human and then get rid of them. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you? Mm. What was the progression of your discovery of your family secrets?
Mm-hmm. Well, really, I didn't know anything for a fact until I went to the German Federal Archives in 2010, and they presented me with 100 pages on my grandparents. It was a dreadful shock. At the same time, as I said to you earlier, this is like any other family secret. Many people have family secrets where you sort of know, but you don't know, or you know, and you turn your sights away because you don't want to upset other people in the family. You want to love your family. You're afraid of what it will do to your family relationships. And unfortunately, yeah, it does rearrange your family relationships. So I can't say at what point. I mean, I can say that when I was a student at Oxford and I chose Polish-German relations in the 20th century, and I was at the same time visiting my grandmother in her apartment and she was tossing out pieces of her ideology, of course I started to put two and two together. And when I was in my early 20s, I asked my American father who came to visit me, so what did, you know, Opa, so my German grandfather, do during the war? Was he one of the perpetrators? And my otherwise lovely, gentle, wonderful American father got very angry with me and said, you may never look into that story again. And so I left it behind for 25 years?
Yes.
There was a belief
So the question is there was a belief that there would be conflict between the Russians and the Americans, and there would be an opportunity for the Nazis who were in Latin America to come back, and whether Julie ran into that line of reasoning at all in her research.
Actually, most of the stuff I read ran contrary to that argument, and most of the stuff I discovered ran contrary to it. And in the case of my grandfather, he left in 1960, which was a different time. Everyone in my family argued to me that, well, you know, he left in 1960, so it had absolutely nothing to do with the war, and of course had everything to do with it. But I think it's also very interesting to in this book there are two books that I would really, you might have read them already. One is by Gerald Steinacher, and then there's wonderful work done by Daniel Stahl about whether or not there were these networks of Nazis who were planning to come back. And honestly, they were never very substantial. They were always rather weak. Yes, there were a few networks, but it's nothing like has been made up in the movies or anything like that. Mostly what I discovered was that in my grandfather's case and the case of others like him, that they just wanted to get as far away as possible from the eye of justice and as far away as possible from this rising human rights movement in the world. So they wanted to get away. Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have leaders in the world who are lowering our standards, and that's the easy answer. That's the straight answer. And even though they aren't themselves Nazis or advocating Nazism, unfortunately what happens is that this encourages and gives a green light to fringe groups, which are still relatively small. You know, let's be real; they're not a major threat. If I could talk about as an example what's happened in Sweden, because this is happening in Sweden, and Sweden is also a center for it's actually a European center for white supremacy on the internet. What we have seen, you know, we have a far right immigrant party that has been making considerable gains in the two last elections, during the run up to the elections, which took place in September, I joined forces with a very well known Holocaust survivor in Sweden to drive up to a town in Sweden which has been completely paralyzed by white supremacists. So people are afraid to pick up their children from school. They're afraid to leave work. I mean, it's that bad. People want to leave that town. So the fact that there are places like that, I'm not going to say that Sweden hasn't turned into that at all, but the fact that there are places like that at all is a result, direct result of these anti-immigrant parties that have been making gains in parliament, who claim not to be fascists, but honestly, they don't just inadvertently encourage those forces. They actually, I mean, I think as we saw here, anyone who remembers Charlottesville, I'm sure we all remember that, mm-hmm. very clear in our minds, how easy it is to encourage those types of movements when the leader of the so-called free world does not immediately and clearly react in unequivocal terms to that type of behavior. The white supremacy? Yeah. Possibly. Possibly. Sweden was also in the 20s actually had the world's leading center for eugenics.
Yeah. So, we have time for one more question. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 Well, first of all, just to address hopefulness, because I think it's also a good note to sort of end on hopefulness. I'm extremely hopeful, which might sound, I don't want to sound naive, I realize. What challenges, like all of you, we I think we all share this feeling of why is this happening in the world right now? But I feel hopeful mainly because my work would not have been possible without an army of individuals who presented themselves to me each time that I thought I might turn back and not do the work. Every time I thought, no, I'm not going to do this anymore, somebody presented themselves and said, hey, I'm here, I share your values, I think the truth is important, let me help you. And I didn't have any money to pay those people. And there are so many of them. So I emerged from this process feeling that there's a great deal of hope. There are more of us who believe in truth, who believe in justice, who believe in human rights, who believe in the global idea, than the people who don't. But unfortunately, we've been too passive for too long. We all need to pick up our tools and do something. Then to the question of how we expand this conversation, well, I started an initiative with, among other people, Rachel, who's sitting right here, called New Voices. You can go to my website and find out about it. And What I'm trying to do with a number of other creatives, so best-selling authors, for example, is to get together and have public conversations about characters we've created, that all of whom somehow relate to this period of history, and looking at this question of how all that happened and how did we get there and how can we stop that from happening again? But do it in a way that's not just... I love reading history books, but there aren't enough people who love reading history books. And so we have to find new ways to engage people to get interested. And I think one of the ways to do that is that creatives, people who are writing books, who are writing novels about the subject matter, who know a great deal, get out, don't just sit in there at their writing desk, but get out into the public with others similar to them and do the work and get the discussions going.
And I would just add one comment on a hopeful note, two comments. President Bill Clinton, at one point, a reporter asked him at a press conference, what advice would you give to my 12-year-old to help him make the world a better place? And he said, tell him to get to know as many people as he can his age who are different from him. And so we need to talk, but we need to talk to people who are different from themselves, from ourselves. And my mother and I speak at schools every week. Recently, we spoke at the least well-performing school in the LA Unified School District. No one who clearly was related to a Holocaust survivor. The history department didn't even want us to give away books, which we normally do. He said, they'll just collect dust. These students, 300 of them, I would not have known the difference by their questions if I were sitting in this room, all African American, a few Latino, dads were in jail, it was surrounded by housing projects. By the time we got home, the librarian called me and she said, I had no idea how these students would respond to you, but it's such a testament to the common humanity in all of us. And we can't forget this. If we talk to each other as human beings, that is the reaction that I've gotten for the last 10 years, talking to the widest diversity of students all across this country. We have to talk, and we have to want to listen to people who are different from ourselves. Thank you so much. We will be signing books right away, right outside. Come meet Julie and come say hi to me. Thanks.
Thank you.